Welcome everyone to episode 430 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're going to take a brief break from playoff analysis because we have to say goodbye to four more teams, the ones who got knocked out in the play-in tournament. So we will be asking what's next for the Indiana Pacers, the Charlotte Hornets, the San Antonio Spurs, and the Golden State Warriors. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we're recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed. Engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today is a guy who I know is excited to talk about teams who are no longer in the playoffs. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
It is going well, and I actually am. Just the other day, I did a whole YouTube breakdown of the Golden State Warriors, which we'll also be talking about today. So I like talking about teams that are out of the playoffs simply because that means they have so much to really fix. And it's always interesting to me to see how teams go into off seasons. Like, what do they change? What have they learned? What do they come back with the next year? So, yes, yeah. I am very much looking forward to talking about these teams.
Well, Lord knows we'll have a lot to talk about.
Yes.
And to discuss what's went wrong with the Pacers this season and what's next for them, we brought the foremost expert on the Indiana Pacers in, Caitlin Cooper, a contributing writer at Indy Cornrows, is joining us today. Caitlin, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm playoff Caitlin now, so I'm going to have to deactivate my mode back to regular Caitlin, because if I'm talking about the Pacers, I don't get to be playoff Caitlin anymore.
Are you happy to see that the Pacers are no longer playing basketball this year? Are you enjoying this break from Pacers basketball?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to thank the Wizards for taking that Sixer first-round matchup away from me so that I wouldn't have to talk about how many screens the Pacers went over against Ben Simmons for the billion
times. Oh, boy. So, obviously, a rough season for the Pacers, especially as we got further along. You know, all of this drama with the head coach, Nate Bjorkgren, came out toward the end of the season. So we have to start there, Caitlin. You know, based on the reporting and kind of what Kevin Pritchard said at the end of season press conference, it sounds like there were just some people management skills that he was lacking this year. So where do you think things went wrong for him? And do you think the Pacers can move forward with him, or are things just so far gone that they have to move on?
Well, I mean, I think I'd start in the first place that over the summer last year, last time I talked to you guys, when I think we were talking about Mike D'Antoni and the Pacers, that it came through reporters that the Pacers were very interested in finding somebody who could be a modern communicator in addition to modernizing the offense. So to hear in the postseason presser that Nate Bjorkgren's having trouble with human management is kind of like, you know, it kind of seems like a failure then at that point, because that was a big talking point in the summer of somebody that you wanted to address. And maybe in the interview process, it was hard to, you know, through Zoom to fully get the picture of what type of person he would be in managing players and staff and whatever else, that you would have gotten better if all of this was, you know, able to do in person. I don't know, but yeah, I mean, I appreciated from Kevin Pritchard in that presser that he didn't just completely shy away from it. There was transparency there and admitted, like, hey, this is something he needs to get better at. If you were to ask me what side he's actually going to come down on, I don't know. Like, even among Pacers Twitter, it seems like there was pretty disparate opinions, as in, was that him kind of laying out the script for Bjorkgren to come in and be self-reflective and they stay the course? Or what, is this them basically stalling until they can get feelers out for if there's another coach available, or, you know, which way they're going to go? But for me, like, I know Kevin Pritchard directly said, like, I have a young coach who is really talented in the X's and O's and he has to get better at human management. Like, I write more from the X's and O's perspective, so that's what I can look at. And, like, pointing out that, you know, I think he'll sit down with us and be self-reflective, but, you know, you look at that last play-in game against the Wizards, and was he, from a basketball standpoint? I mean, they lost every game they played to the Wizards, and the injuries certainly mattered. Like, I'm not going to act like it didn't matter that Karis and TJ Warren and Miles Turner were out. It did, and he deserves a break for that. But knowing what players you had available to come out with the same defensive game plan against Russell Westbrook for the fourth game in a row, and then you're talking about like how good he was at X's and O's, like you can't duck under a screen against Russell Westbrook in a play-in tournament game. Like, you know, you don't have Miles Turner as a rim protector, and while you can't reorient the whole defense around what you would need to do if Sabonis was at the five, like that's not even reasonable to ask Bjorkren to do that. You're not asking that much to send people under so you can try to keep him out of the paint and ask him to beat you as a shooter. Like, to me, that was just like inexcusable just on that aspect alone. So can you really trust this person to be his exact opposite next year, not only from the human management standpoint, but also are you going to be more adaptable? And that was something that I thought he was going to be really good at, because if you watched his games in the G League, a lot of his teams did not look the same. Like, he didn't coach them all. And like this year, I think you could argue pretty strongly that he coached this team to be the Toronto Raptors. And offensively, that did a lot of good things for the Pacers. But I don't think defensively the Pacers are Pascal Siakam and OG Anunoby and have that type of side-to-side movement to be doing a lot of the things that he asked of them, in addition to just the overboard with overs.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was following you all year, and it seemed like you were just getting progressively more broken by the Pacers' defense as the year went on. So...
Well, their defense got progressively more broken as the season went on.
So, yeah, that's what I wanted to ask. Like, I know it wasn't just a Wizards issue. Like, what went wrong defensively for this team this year? Do you think it was, you know, personnel not fitting the scheme, the injuries, or just a scheme making no sense, like regardless of personnel?
Right, so I'll fully admit that when he first did his preseason presser, his introductory one, he described that he wanted the defense to be aggressive and disruptive, and then he did several radio interviews where he started mentioning like triangle and two and other things they wanted to mix in, and I was like, this sounds a lot like the whirling approach the Raptors used. And I wrote a piece before the season even started, like, do the Pacers have the pieces to be doing this shape-shifting defense? And I was concerned about it. Then they came out in the first game in preseason, and they were pressuring people, the Cavs, three-quarter court, like, off makes and misses with Brogdon, with Aaron Holiday. Like, that is going to be tiring for a shortened offseason where guys really didn't have the opportunity to be in condition to play that type of defense, let alone how many odd man advantages they were giving up just in those games. So then the season starts. TJ Warren's back for the first four games, and it's looking better. So I was like, I'm a person who likes to admit when they're wrong. I don't want to double down. So it looked like it was working better. They were very aggressive at the nail. They were swapping recovery paths really well to be doing this type of swarming, you know, ball pressure defense. So I thought, I'm going to write that piece. Miles Turner looks like a Defensive Player of the Year candidate. And then it wasn't early in the season. It took a little bit for them to start mixing in the zone looks. And then you also have to factor in that Victor Oladipo gets traded. And Victor and Karis are very different defenders, what you can do with the two of them. Like, at least thus far, we don't know what Karis will look like next year when he's had more time to recover from everything that he went through this year. But just Victor's ability to, he has such good closing speed, and his ability to roam the entire floor suits this sort of, you know, swarming system better than some of the lapses that Karis can show. And then they just didn't have Karis for a long time. They don't have TJ Warren to guard wings and his on ball defense. So there's gaps, but the zone just never looked right. Like, bump downs are non-existent. And the 2-3, the box and one, I don't know. I don't know if it's because they didn't have practice time, but it never looked, and this is going to sound harsh, but it never looked competent. So now you're trying all these different things at the same time, and you're never really getting good at anything. So at the end of the year, they try to simplify it, because, I mean, I wrote a piece about, I literally titled it, their junk defenses look like junk against the Wizards, because they didn't have Miles. And it's like they chase out of zones, even though they're supposed to be playing box and one. They were trapping the wing in the zone. I don't know why. And then they weren't using pass denials, even though they were trapping the wing, like, just very messy. So they tried to simplify it, but it's like, at this point, it's too little too late, because you're not even settled in your base scheme. And your base scheme, and this is why they need to know what they're doing with the centers, like, they gave up the highest opponent rim frequency in the NBA. And that was still like third, even when Miles Turner was on the court. So can you sustain funneling this much action to the basket in today's NBA? I think it exacerbated their rebounding issues. They gave up the most points in the paint. They gave up, I believe, the most second chance points, or were close to it, bottom of the league, and I think an opponent offensive rebounding rate. So when you're having to constantly sell out for blocks or constantly sell out for contests for a team that already doesn't have a lot of plus rebounders, it just created a lot of problems. And I just don't think, if you're going to have Sabonis at the five, that you can play this funneling scheme and expect to have good results. And And not even that, but what you mentioned, like if you're playing Sabonis at the four or the five in this Raptor style system, he led the league in distance traveled on defense as a center. Like, I mean, that's just obscene to me. That's never happened since the NBA started tracking the data. And when he's at the four, he's being asked to do all this help and fly. He's helping at the nail. They're having him hedge. They switch him out without protecting him in those switches. So, I have some questions about the feasibility of that. But I guess the one thing I could hang my hat on is maybe if they have a full training camp and they can really teach these types of concepts, it would look better in function with more time and when everybody's healthy. If they choose to keep Bjorkren, that's what you would have to count on. But I can't say I feel good about that with what I saw all season this year.
Yeah, no,
that's my long-winded soliloquy on the defense.
I'm glad you brought it up because here's the thing. A lot of Pacers fans are basically putting all the blame on Sabonis. Whenever I watch games and whenever Brian watched games, he and I would talk about him and go, why are Pacers fans blaming Sabonis? It's clearly him being just overmatched and overchallenged with such a burden of running around, having to, like you said, recover and cover so much ground at the same time. I just don't really fathom why he's being sort of the culprit for this defense.
Well, I think some of it stems from that early Miles missed some games, I believe, because of the fracture he had in his hand. So they played against Dallas and the Clippers, and they just got absolutely killed on defense. And that was when they were really mixing in some of the, what I would say, quote-unquote gimmicky things. Like, they were trying to blitz Luka constantly, and they didn't have the length or the cohesion to be doing that with the types of lineups they had. So they were getting killed on a lot of the background rotations in that particular game. And then they were trying to play triangle and two and box and one against the Clippers early in the season. And again, like I can't probably describe this without showing the video, but it would end up where Sabonis would be trapping out or would be coming up from low box out of the wing to contest shots at three instead of bringing the nail person in so he could play solo back line. Like, those types of mistakes are occurring, but then you're seeing a huge point total and it's like, well, Miles Turner isn't here, so therefore the only thing that's changed is that Sabonis is playing and Miles isn't. And that's no knock against Miles. Miles is a terrific pick and roll defender. He's a great shot blocker and rim protector. Like, there's no denying that. But to peg all this on him, like, for me, I would have to look at last season and be like, why weren't the on-off numbers so exaggerated last year when you basically had the same roster? You were starting Jeremy Lamb. Jeremy Lamb is no better defender than Karras. He's probably worse. So there wasn't a massive on-off difference versus for Miles. I mean, even since Sabonis was traded, I looked up this number that in the games that Miles Turner did not play, which is like 30 plus 900 some total minutes, their defensive rating was 105 when Dan Burke was coordinating the defense. So that's not all Sabonis. Obviously there were some personnel differences in the earlier years where you have guys like Thad and Corey Joseph who are stronger defenders than some of the players they have now, but I'm just not a huge I don't ascribe to the theory that all of the defense is just a matter of Sabonis can't be a rim protector, especially because if the Pacers did decide this summer, like, hey, you know, we think we need to play smaller and we're going to choose a five and they were to choose Sabonis, this is not the type of defense you would play. You would be doing more to scheme for rim protection rather than, in my opinion, sometimes over-relying on Miles to constantly be cleaning up everybody else's mistakes while you ball pressure with, you know, giving up the odd man advantages constantly.
So regardless of whether, since we don't know Bjorkren's future, we can't speculate either way. The good news or silver lining potentially for the Pacers is that most of their big players are under contract next year. Brogdon, Sabonis, Turner, LeVert, Warren, all under contract. Jeremy Lamb as well, Justin Holiday. So they're returning most of their team. They don't have to worry about huge free agent defections. The two notable ones that our free agents are TJ McConnell and Doug McDermott. So, Caitlin, if you were running the Pacers, would you prioritize one over the other? Would you be trying to bring both of those guys back? You know, how valuable were those guys to the Pacers this year?
I mean, very. I think that you ideally don't want Doug McDermott to be starting games and probably don't want TJ McConnell to be having to play 35 plus in certain games. I mean, if you could keep them both, that's what you would do. I think that both of them indicated a desire to stay, and I think it seemed like Kevin Pritchard would like to retain them both. I highly question that you're going to be able to do that and stay under the luxury tax. So for me, if it comes down to a choice between one or the other, again, as much as I hate talking about whether these two bigs fit together, because I like both of them, you kind of need to have an eye toward the future, I think, a little bit. Because if I'm the Pacers and I think I'm going to retain Sabonis, I want Doug McDermott on my team. The number one assist combo on the Pacers was Sabonis to Doug McDermott. I think having a movement shooter and somebody who can really attack, I mean, I've said this before, but if I was Doug McDermott's agent, I would be showing everybody in the league the tape of him against the Phoenix Suns this year. The guy just put on a total clinic against top blocking with Mikal Bridges on him, like just really, really good, and how they attack the drop coverage as well as that. But so I would lean Doug if you think you're going to be keeping Sabonis long term. But if you think that you might move Sabonis and try to retain assets, then I would definitely lean TJ McConnell, because you need to make up that playmaking some way, somehow, and TJ gives you more of that off the bench. The interesting thing too is, I was talking with this about somebody yesterday, that it's like, you look at the lineups that you'd be able to have, whichever one of them you keep, and I don't know what their plans are for Jeremy Lamb, quite frankly, but like, if TJ's gone, then you're looking at Aaron Holiday as backup point guard, and it would probably be like, you know, Doug, Justin, O'Shea, Goga. Do you trust Aaron Holiday to be making solid plays for three guys who are basically spot up shooters and Goga? Like, that's a lineup thing that I would need to look at. Versus if it's TJ, then you'd probably be playing like Edmund, Justin, O'Shea, Goga, and you would have TJ's playmaking, but then how much do you believe in Edmund and O'Shea shooting to retain? Because that's not a lot of shooting. So I think that the Pacers are in a spot where they're going to have to try to make some assumptions about their roster, because there's just not a lot that they can firmly know. Mm-hmm. But my decision on that would lean towards, first of all, do they actually want to be here? What's the pricing? And then I think that they do need to have an idea of, if we do have to make a decision with our bigs, which one of them is it going to be? Because mm-hmm. one of those people fits a little bit better with the other, I think. But
yeah, I don't want to ask that same question about right. Sabonis and Turner, because I know that's been.
But you kind of have to. I mean, it's so annoying. But
yeah, I've gone through it with Simmons and Embiid for years now as well. I know. You know, it gets annoying at times, of course, but, bigger picture, I guess, beyond just Sabonis and Turner, because they have everyone under contract next year, they could just run this thing back, you know,
right.
hopefully retain one or both of McConnell and McDermott, and just say, you know, injuries did us in, or this coaching stuff did us in, and maybe, you know, with another year under our belts, we could just have a much more successful season next year. Where do you stand on, you know, would you just try to run this thing back? And do you think this team, as currently constructed, either could be a top six seed in the East, or, you know, genuinely contend for a title? Or do you think they need to make some more substantive changes, whether it's breaking up Sabonis and Turner and moving Warren full time to the four, whether it's adding another playmaker? I don't know. I mean, where do you stand on this roster as currently constructed?
I think we need like a dinging noise for every time I say I don't know, because we're probably getting up there pretty high. But yeah, I mean, in a lot of respects, I don't know, because they literally have not played a minute of action together with those five players.
Yeah.
So I don't quite fully know how to assess how those five will fit together. But again, what I said before, making some assumptions. They struggled in a lot of games this year where, you know, whether it was OG Anunoby, Harrison Barnes, Mikal Bridges, Giannis, having somebody that can guard those types of people. And yes, TJ Warren was out, but the one thing that I would note about TJ Warren last year is they kind of also had this whole guarding bigger fours then too. Like, this was something that we all talked about pretty regularly, that you don't have somebody to put on, and nobody's stopping Giannis, but, you know, having somebody to catch his first step, they didn't really have a person like that. And TJ Warren made a lot of strides as a defender, shout out Dan Burke, but I think some of it is that he was probably arguably their best on-ball defender. Like, there was times where they would put him on Devin Booker, or they would put him on Jamal Murray so that Malcolm Brogdon isn't doing the point of attack defense. So I don't know if that completely remedies, but if you had a different defensive system, maybe you could, I don't want to say hide, but live with some of that a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, I would say I'm not opposed to seeing more of it, because I like all five of those guys. I think that they all bring unique and different skill sets. It's just a matter of whether it meshes. It would come down to, you know, I don't want to make it a choice between Bjorkren and the starting five, but I feel like something would have to give there. Either he would have to acquiesce on some of what he's doing, or I feel like you would need to make somewhat of a roster shift if you think you're going to be constantly continuing to pressure defensively in the way that you were. I mean, offensively, I thought that Bjorkren did a lot of good things in terms of revamping stuff so it wasn't just standstill pick and roll. There's a lot more nuance to some of what they do, but I think you could see your way through to, like what you said, you know, TJ Warren in the bubble really exploded at the four spot. Does that still happen if he's not playing at the four and he's back at the small forward position? Does he pop in the same way? Does he get the same touches? Just some of those tiny things. Like, I don't know that I would say I'm fully committed to it, but I wouldn't balk at it if they brought it back. I think that they could definitely be a playoff team and get out of maybe, you know, a first round, depending upon what the matchups are, and be competitive in a second round, depending upon what the matchups are. But I don't know that I would pick that group to knock off Milwaukee or knock off Brooklyn. Like, and then it goes back to that, like, who on this roster really even has a chance of defending somebody like Kevin Durant? And again, you're not stopping him, but I don't think that that hole is necessarily completely addressed. Like, O'Shea Brissett was a revelation at the end of the season, like a great low buy there. But I think some of his defensive contributions are more like side to side and what he can do in the gaps. And a lot of what he did as a help defender, weak side rim protector, more so than it is that, I mean, he had some real struggles in the game they played against the Kings, just against Marvin Bagley. So they don't really have, I think, like a silver bullet at the four. It's more how are you going to do that somewhat by committee. But I know Mort's been pretty up on what the Pacers can look like if they're fully healthy.
Yeah, I'm super optimistic about it. I think my issue, and you kind of outline it, it is whether the pieces fit together collectively. Individually, I think this Pacers team might actually, or I don't even think might, this Pacers team have more collective raw talent than the Pacers team with Paul George and Roy Hibbert and David West back in the day. This is a supremely talented roster. It's just a matter of figuring out, do we need to move just a small amount of those pieces away to get other pieces in so that makes the entire puzzle like go up in a more united unit? Or do we run out what we have right now and just cross our fingers and hope for the best and see if the implementation of TJ Warren is that good or that we can sort of ignore every other aspect? Like, the defensive concerns are absolutely real. I don't think that solution is going to be found necessarily internally. But if they can be one of those top-tier offensive teams, which I said to Brian on multiple occasions that I think they could be, I mean, maybe that's enough to make a decent playoff run in the East. I don't know.
Right. And it's somewhat like, I'm not completely sure I understand what type of team they want to be, because last year at the end of the season, they talked about, you know, wanting to play a little bit faster, modernizing the offense, which made total sense after, you know, moving on from Nate McMillan. I think that had somewhat of a limited ceiling with this roster. And now this year, I think that, I mean, they really dialed up the pace, but to me that was somewhat a response to, if you can't get stops and you can't rebound, you have to get extra possessions. You don't have a choice. So towards the back end of the season, they were like top three in pace, and you know, is that something for these guys to continue? But now in the post-game presser, they were talking about, we need to get back to hard hat defense, and we don't have the same advantages as a small market team recruiting free agents, and we need to get back to some of our defensive identity, which I don't necessarily disagree with, but I also think there's a limited ceiling to being a defense first team. I mean, offense is popping everywhere. Like, there has to be, they have to strike the right balance with the roster that they have. And I wouldn't want them to go too far in the opposite direction back to what they already were, because they already found that didn't work. So,
yeah, and they would have to overturn most of the roster anyway if they want to go defense first. Right. I mean, you can stick with Miles, but then what do you do with Sabonis, LeVert, like maybe even TJ is actually pretty good, but like you said, Jeremy Lamb, who isn't as a strong defender, Doug McDermott, like what do they do with those guys if they want to pivot?
Malcolm Brogdon quietly has his own defensive issues. Like, I know a lot of people look back at the series he had against Kawhi, and he did do some good things when he was still with Milwaukee, but I mean, especially in this system, he can be a stiff defender, and I don't feel great about, you know, with the amount of burden he carries sometimes offensively, which Caris LeVert will ease some of that once they get more games for sure. But guarding, like sometimes he'll be primary against Giannis, and then that's a lot to carry. But I mean, his point of attack defense is not great, to put it kindly.
So my final two questions, because you brought up Brogdon, I have to ask. One, can I have him on the Sixers? And two, how much should Danny Ainge regret not signing and trading Gordon Hayward for Miles Turner and Doug McDermott this past summer?
Right. So, I mean, the relitigating the Hayward-Turner topic is one of my favorite things to do. I mean, I live for that. But
So does Brian.
I really do.
I mean, look what Robert Williams did in that first game against Brooklyn. I mean, he was racking up block shots. I mean, that's mainly what you would be getting from the Miles Turner trade if they've done it. I mean, I definitely think Miles Turner would have been an upgrade over Tristan Thompson. I mean, he's just an overall better rim protector. He's going to offer you more. I'm not exactly sure where Danny Ainge – I don't think Miles Turner is an albatross contract, like for sure not. So I'm not fully settled on where he was coming with that or what the order of operations was there. I mean, the Pacers were not going to pay him what Charlotte did, but there was rumblings that he was willing to take less if he could come play for the Pacers. So it'd be interesting to know from both teams, like if you could do that over again, like if you're the Pacers, would you still want Gordon Hayward? And if you're the Celtics, would you have been like, yeah, we're going to do that, because getting Doug McDermott and Miles Turner would have made us more complete? I don't know. It seems like they feel pretty good about what Robert Williams is offering them right now, but that wasn't the case early in the season, at least not to the extent that you saw in that playoff game.
Yeah, and he's coming up. He's eligible for an extension already. So just as he's getting good, now they're going to have to pay him, and it's going to get exorbitantly expensive to keep him. I just love relitigating that trade because Celtics fans are just convinced that, like, you know, I guess he wanted Turner and Oladipo for Hayward instead. And now, in retrospect, given Oladipo's injury history and what happened this year, I guess that's not a ridiculous price anymore. But at the time, that's absurd. So
right.
It's always fun to just pour a little.
And then as it turned out, neither of them even played in the play-in games anyways. So
right. There you go. That's true.
And Brian, you can have Malcolm Brogdon if you give Caitlin Ben Simmons.
Yeah.
Then it'll finally have some defense.
I do have a strong affinity for Thibault, so you can toss him there. I do have a very strong affinity.
I was willing to part with Tyrese Maxey. I can't give up Thibault anymore. He's too good.
Only Tyrese Maxey and Paul Reed. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. That's oh, it. No, not B-Ball Paul. B-Ball Paul's off limits, too. Mort, any final questions for Caitlin before we let her get going?
Yeah, so obviously I've been super high on O'Shea Brissett, and he's 22. I think that goes a little bit forgotten. When the Pacers signed him, people are kind of looking at him as one of those late season signings. People are kind of gauging him as a veteran, which obviously in the grand scheme of things, he isn't. He's really young, very limited NBA experience. Is there a cause for optimism just in terms of his future progress and development?
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the things, like, and again, I don't want this to sound like I'm the most negative person alive, but O'Shea and Edmund Sumner's development late in the season was one of the things that kept me really engaged with the team. I mean, seeing him come over, they didn't have both bigs. The Pacers had Miles and Sabonis out for a time, so he was even pinch hitting at like small ball five in some units, and seeing like their weak side help was just so non-existent in so many games. It was like a revelation, like, a guy rotated over and tagged somebody. It is so nice to see. So, I mean, that alone, I liked O'Shea just for defense, but then his shooting, like I think he's over 40 on like, what, four attempts per game? I don't have that number in front of me, but
I think it was 42.
Yeah. I mean, he shot the ball really well. And whether, I mean, I those two guys are really hard workers. So I'd like to think that the shooting can stay in the high 30s if he continues to work hard on it. Just like Edmund, you can tell that his mechanics are a little bit different, which gives me hope that could stay that way. But I think they see O'Shea as a rotation player, and I think that could help them, because I mean, I don't know that I necessarily think he's a starter like what he was doing down the stretch, but if you can play him at backup four, that's been a hole for the Pacers for a while. And then Justin Holiday's not having to do it, because you look at Justin's shooting splits, I mean, those were in the low 30s for about March and April, like a 30-game stretch where it just looked like he got worn down because he gets asked to do so many things. He started games, he gets switched, and he has to guard bigger fours. Sometimes he steps over, like I said, for Brogdon, and he'll be guarding point guards. And like the fourth quarter, you'll see him guarding, you know, John Wall or Colin Sexton or whoever it is that they're struggling to get stops against. And it looked like he got worn down. So if you have O'Shea Brissett for a full season and he can play off the bench at the four, I think that helps Justin, and it just gives them overall more balance and optionality in what they can do. Like maybe you do feel better sometimes, like we need to play small, so we'll split our bigs and O'Shea can do some of that. Like he isn't a movement shooter, which would be nice to have around Sabonis when you're running some of your Chicago stuff. Like he's definitely more of a spot up shooter. But the one thing also that popped with him is just how good his instincts are as a cutter. Obviously we know that the Pacers and the Raptors run nearly identical playbooks. So he had experience with Bjorkren from having been in the Raptors system last year. And they run a set where they run like a ghost screen on one side and then they 45 cut from the other. And he just never spoils the spacing, just has really good instincts there. So a lot of optimism, I think, in what he can add as like an eighth or ninth guy for the team going into next year.
And final question, when will you be taking over for Nate?
Hopefully never. That would be so bad. Like, I don't think people understand how hard it is to be making some of the decisions. Like, I mean, I think I would have been sending people under screens against Russell Westbrook, but be making in-game adjustments and decisions without me being able to, like, I get up in the morning and rewatch an entire game and then formulate an article off that. I don't think that would work. Hey, I need to rewatch that quarter on the iPad and then I'll be ready to make some adjustments in the second quarter. But yeah.
Well, I'm glad we could end on a high note. So, Caitlin, thank you again for joining us today. Can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter, where they can find your work, and anything that you're going to be doing throughout the rest of the playoffs?
Right. So my handle is at C2_Cooper. I'm at Indie Cornrows. Usually have about one or two pieces there a week, though in the off season, I don't do draft content, so that might get a little bit thinner here for about the next month or so. But if I notice stuff in the playoffs, I have some outstanding contacts where I can reach out and say, hey, you want this freelance piece randomly about Jonas Valanciunas, and see if people will take me up on the offer. So if you want to read about Jonas Valanciunas in the dunker spot, apparently all I do is write about Lithuanian centers. So there you go.
I dig it. More love for JB. I'm down with it.
Yeah, if you like writing about players in the dunker spot, may I introduce you to the Philadelphia 76ers?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's definitely the team I should be writing about full time.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Well, if you want Thybulle too, there we go. I'm expecting a full 2,000-word breakdown on what makes Matisse Thybulle so good defensively.
Incredible recovery skills there.
That was easy. All right, well, thanks again, Caitlin. Best of luck this offseason. I hope it's not as anxiety-inducing as this season was for you, and hope you get to enjoy the rest of the playoffs as well.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
Anytime.
Well, thanks again to Caitlin Cooper for joining us for that awesome Pacers breakdown. We are also going to now follow up, talk about the other three teams that got knocked out in the play-in tournament. Mort, let's start with the Charlotte Hornets, who had quite a revelatory season, especially with the breakout of LaMelo Ball. They're in pretty good shape roster-wise, but they do have some big decisions to make. Two biggest ones, I'd say, right away. Devontae Graham, Malik Monk are both restricted free agents this summer. So, Mort, should they be trying to re-sign those guys, and what's a fair price point, or what's the price point where you walk away?
Oh, it's a super interesting question, because now that they have LaMelo, you can definitely make the argument that they don't really need to go out and spend a whole lot of money on Graham or Monk, because they have a guy now at that guard spot who can really propel them forward. So I'm looking at the situation going, what do they really need? Do they, first and foremost, do they trust that this year from Malik Monk is permanent? Like, do they believe that this leap is legit? This was a 42-game sample. He played less than 21 minutes per game, but he did look good as a shooter. I think the big question here is, can he be a self-creator? Can he be more than just a scorer? And quite frankly, I'm not sure. I think they have a walkaway price. What that price is for Malik Monk, I really don't know. But I would be a little bit surprised if he came back.
Yeah, I would too. And Graham, I think you raise a fair point as well. You know, you've got LaMelo and Terry Rozier in the starting lineup, Gordon Hayward at the three. So, you know, really his, at best, he's probably plugging in as your backup point guard off the bench, and you're probably not spending $20 million on that spot, especially for a guy whose career high over three seasons is shooting 38.2% from the field. So, so what do you do with Graham? Like, what's, you know, are you willing to go up to, you know, 4 years, $50 million for him, let's say?
So that's 4 years, 60 total.
It'd be like 12 and a half per year.
Oh, sorry. I thought you said 15.
No, oh, 50, 50. So 12 and a half.
Oh, 50. Yeah, I thought you said 15 and then annually. Okay. Oh, my bad. I was like, that's a lot of money. Okay, no, 50 million over 4 years. That's a different math. I would feel way more comfortable with that than I would a $60 million contract. That said, though, it's one of those situations because the Knicks are in the market for a point guard, allegedly. Mm-hmm. That could be LaMelo Ball, but if it's not Ball, Devontae Graham could be one of those guys. He's been linked to the Knicks in those rumors, in particular because he can't shoot the three ball. I mean, I know you already mentioned his shooting percentage from the field overall, but as a three-point shooter, he's pretty good because he's a high-volume, somewhat high-efficiency player. He can knock down free throws. He's a good passer. So if he comes into that Knicks system and is just basically catching and shooting from the point guard position, which you could argue they already have in Emmanuel Quickly, but okay, let's put that aside. That would probably be a worth 12.5, if not more, per year, simply because the floor spacing that he provides. I don't know if what my walk-away price is, though. Like, he's still not super old. I think he's, what, 26, 25, 26, along he's those 20, lines?
He turned 26 in February.
Yeah, okay, so the potential might not be there. He's probably more of a finished product by now. But you know what you're getting. You know you're getting a guy who can come in and give you a high assist count, like function as the primary play initiator if that's what you want him to do. You know he can hit threes. You know he can rely on him on the three-throw line. So what is that worth? Well, then you also have to factor in his defense, which is not great, the fact that he's a very slight 6'1". And then you have to figure out, is that something we live with ultimately? So I think I would probably, if I'm the Hornets, I would just not play that game. If the Knicks came in with an offer of like $14 million per year or $13 million or something like that, I probably wouldn't do it unless I knew that I had a resale market for Graham if I then matched that contract and then was able to flip it later on. So maybe Nene him could be the best option, that potentially.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because it's a matter of asset allocation and resource allocation, and as you said, do you want to be spending that much money
right
not knowing that he's going to be in your starting lineup moving forward? Now Terry Rozier is entering the last year of his contract, so maybe you think you're at risk of losing Rozier and you want that insurance in case he does leave,
right?
So there's a lot to juggle for the Hornets here, but yeah, the Knicks, I think, are a team to watch. We'll see. I mean, I know the Bulls are in the market for a point guard as well. If they don't get Lonzo, maybe Devontae could be of interest, or maybe if Lonzo leaves, the Pelicans might need a point guard, and maybe Devontae's of interest to them too. So both of these guys should not struggle to find offers on the market. I just don't know whether either of their futures are in Charlotte, but the Hornets, you know, will have the opportunity to match any offer sheet either one signed. So that is the good thing. They don't, you know, they can present these guys with an offer at the start of free agency, but if those guys don't find it suitable, they can say, okay, find something else, and we'll get, you know, a couple days to decide whether or not we want to match it.
Yeah, and just to put any fears to rest here or any doubts to rest, Terry Rozier should be prioritized over Graham, over Monk. He clearly has shown that he is a mainstay on that roster, even alongside LaMelo, honestly. I mean, I don't care. Then you flip him around in terms of point guard, shooting guard. Like, that's not a concern to me. He's just so productive that I think you've got to run with him moving forward. So those are the guys they prioritize. And if Graham and Monk are kind of lost in the whole shuffle of things, I don't think it hurts them that much.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. The other big question for them, contract-wise, is Miles Bridges. He's heading into the final year of his rookie deal, so he will be eligible for an extension. If you're the Hornets, would you extend him, and how much would you give him?
Yeah, I would. I mean, he is legitimately good, and I think he is one of the most undervalued players in the league. It's not just the dunking. It's the improved shooting. It's the improved defense. It's the improved virtually everything. He's not going to be, I think, ever one of those high-level scorers. Mm-hmm. So I think offensively there is a ceiling to his game, which it can kind of concern me if I'm like giving him $17, $18 million a year, which I think in an open market he would get very, very easily. So I would feel comfortable with $15 million a year. I would feel less comfortable if we're up at $18, and I would feel very uncomfortable if it's way above $20.
Yeah. No, I think that's the right kind of area to be focused on. I will say, I mean, he fits so well with LaMelo Ball. And I think for the Hornets, all of these decisions ultimately need to come down to that. How we construct a roster around Ball's talents, which guys fit well with him. You know, because Gordon Hayward, I know they just signed him to a 4-year deal, but he's already on the wrong side of 30. So he's not going to be there for, you know, ideally you have LaMelo Ball at least for the next 7 to 8 years. So you need to be thinking with that timeline in mind. Now, Miles Bridges just finished his third NBA season. He's only 23 years old. So he's got, you know, he's much more on the developmental timeline of LaMelo Ball. But, you know, do you want to commit that much money to him and, you know, lock up that much money that you could also be using to improve your roster elsewhere? I don't know.
Yes, actually, yes. So here's my reasoning. I would actually maybe even pay him a little bit more above market value to retain him for one reason. If they lose out on Graham and Monk in free agency, right? Those shots will be absorbed by somebody.
Yeah, that's true.
That could be Miles Bridges. And if Miles takes his scoring average from like the 13 that he's been on this year and last, and he goes to like 16, 17, that's a shift in the market right there. So if you can get him in right now, lock him in and go, yeah, we have you for the next 4 years. Why not?
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think the other big question for them is what to do at center. You know, PJ Washington was their nominal starting center for a good portion of the year. Cody Zeller is a free agent. Bismack Biyombo is a free agent. I don't think either of those guys are the future at the position for Charlotte. So who would you target on the free agent market? Like, would you go after Andre Drummond, for instance? Or do you have anyone else in mind?
Yeah, I do. Daniel Tice.
Ooh, that's a good one. I like that.
Yep. Both Keith Smith and I are on the same page with this one. He just makes so much sense on the Hornets. He's low usage, but he is effective. He plays defense. He passes the ball. He rebounds. He's tough-nosed. He gives you everything. And he probably comes at a price tag of around, I want to say between 9 and 11 million, maybe even a little bit more. If it's a little bit more, I don't mind. Like, he's just so rock solid that I think that would be a tremendous signing for them. I think he would fit that team like a glove.
Yeah, I like that. I was going to say Nerlens, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Or Rashawn Holmes could be another option.
Rashawn is not a bad name either. That would be really interesting, actually.
Yeah. I mean, they could, you know, go the restricted free agent route and go after a guy like Jared Allen, but if you could get Nerlens on the cheap, I mean, he's played for $5 million this year with the Knicks.
Yeah.
He might just want to stay with the Knicks. Like, this might just be, you know, he's kind of got revitalized under Tibbs, so maybe he's not available. But, yeah, those would probably be, I agree, Drummond, I would not throw a ton of money at Andre Drummond. I'd much rather go after Rashawn, Nerlens. Tice is a great name. Yeah, I don't even know. I mean, I guess we'd see if like the market totally dried up and they haven't found an answer, that's when you can get frisky and throw an offer sheet at Jared Allen, but I probably would not prioritize him over Rashawn or these other guys.
Right, and look, Cleveland might match that offer anyway. So
yeah, or they might just sign him to an extension, you know, right when free agency starts and take him off the market.
That could very well be.
Yeah. All right, let's turn our attention now more to the San Antonio Spurs. Shout out to our old co-host Sarah and our friend Jesse. I know he's been eager for this section, so let's get right into it, Mort. They have a lot of guys coming off the books this summer. DeMar DeRozan is the top name, of course. It seemed like, as of last year, DeMar DeRozan was getting the hell out of San Antonio at the first chance he could. You know, Jabari Young of CNBC in particular, who's plugged in to DeRozan's camp, it seems, just made it clear that DeRozan was very unhappy there, did not want to be there. He reinvented himself this year and seemed to really find a groove as this like point power forward.
Yeah.
So do you think it makes sense for the Spurs to re-sign DeRozan, or do you think they should go their separate ways?
So I will say this. I hate the idea less than I did a year ago because, yeah, you know, it just seemed like that future wasn't in the card for either side. But no, he's still a tremendous scorer, even if he doesn't shoot threes. Like, let's just put that aside for, mm-hmm, for a period of time. I don't think it's that crucial right now. He's still a tremendous scorer. He's a tremendous playmaker. He's very careful with the basketball. He gets to the free throw line a ton, where he also converts, by the way, at an 88% rate. Good on you, DeMar. That's an insane rate. So there is a very, very high floor in terms of his production. So if the Spurs buy into that, they know, you know what, the guy we're getting back is undoubtedly a 20-plus point scorer. He's undoubtedly a 6-plus assist type of guy. We know that overall, even if he doesn't shoot a whole lot of threes, he's going to be efficient for us. We know the baseline, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's about getting that known quantity in and saying, you know, we want you here. We want at the same time to develop Deontay, Derek White, Keldon, you know, Jakob Poeltl, Lonnie Walker, those guys, Devin Vassell as well. But so the question I have here is, can you agree with DeRozan to an extent where he understands what he's getting on board with? Mm-hmm. That's the key issue for me, because after all, he is going to be 32 this year. I believe he's born in 89, right? Yes. So he's going to be 32 this year. And the Spurs, I feel, are still at least a few years away from really being superbly competitive again.
Yeah.
And so you could make the argument that the presence of DeMar might accelerate their development a little bit because of his passing chops and because they wouldn't have to like be forced into these great offensive roles, in which case, if you can get DeMar to sign off of that, cool. But I also fully understand if he just says, you know what? No, I want to win. Yeah. I never won a championship. I'm going to be 32. I don't have a whole lot of time left. I want to go elsewhere. In which case, then the Spurs and DeMar maybe can work out a sign-and-trade deal. Mm-hmm. Maybe he has enough affinity for them to the point where, yeah, I'll work that out with you so you can get something in return. That's fine. Or maybe it's just one of those amicable goodbyes where he leaves and everyone is like, yeah, makes sense. And then when he returns, everyone stands up and gives him a, I don't know, 1 minute of it standing.
Yeah, the nice return video. Yeah, I think, yeah, you're totally right. It comes down to what DeMar wants for the next chapter of his career.
Right.
And it's also about the fit. I mean, I know it's fair to acknowledge how effective he was. He was like an all-star caliber player this year.
Yes.
But the lack of three-point shooting makes it difficult to plug him in anywhere. Like, I'd seen, yes, his name connected with Miami, and I just do not understand that at all, because you already have Jimmy Butler and Benson, and Bam Adebayo, who, you know, the spacing is going to get really clunky there. Yeah. I've seen him mentioned in conjunction with the Lakers. I also not quite sure I see the fit there, other than, you know, he's an L.A. guy, or a California guy. So,
well, there's another destination. Mavs fans love him.
Do they? That could actually be interesting.
It could. They want him aggressively.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. I like that fit. Yeah.
It's not bad, right?
No. So I bottom line is, I think DeMar DeRozan and the Spurs are probably parting ways this summer. But I agree with you. A sign and trade could be beneficial to him as well, because if you look at the teams projected to have cap space, the Knicks, Spurs are actually number two, according to our friend Keith Smith. Otherwise, Dallas, you know, could have upwards of $34 million if Josh Richardson declines his player option. Toronto could have $25 million, but we'll see. You know, Kyle Lowry would wipe all that out.
Well, would he though?
Lowry? Oh, like you're like thinking he would take a pay, yeah, cut to get his buddy back?
Yeah. I mean, I understand it's romantic,
yeah,
and I understand that maybe that doesn't align at all with the financial truths of the game.
Right.
But, like, Kyle and DeMar were tight.
Yeah.
Like, they were really, really tight. Maybe there is a component here where Kyle says, you know what, that's fine. We'll figure something out. Just get DeMar in here. I'll take whatever's left. Right. I don't know. I'm not saying it would happen, but you know what? It would be a great story.
Yeah.
I would love it. You would love it. The city of Toronto damn sure would love it. DeMar would love it. Kyle would love it. It would be love all around, Brian. And look, this world needs more love.
Or what if they look at the Knicks with upwards of $50 million in cap space?
Yeah.
And say, we can go team up again. Let's go play with Julius Randle. Let's go play with RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley.
Nice. We have young DeRozan and old DeRozan.
All right. So
I'm actually kidding. Barrett has turned into a very good shooter. Yes, that's a joke that worked last year.
Yeah. So DeRozan is not the Spurs' only notable free agent. They also have Patty Mills and Rudy Gay coming off the books. Would you just go full youth movement if you're the Spurs more? Or would you try to keep one or both of those guys?
No, video tribute.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense at this point. Like, your young guys are now kind of coming into their own, especially Murray and White. And I know we talk, I always call White, or I always lump him in with the young guy core, but he's going to turn 27
in July. He's closer to 30 than he is 20.
I know. But you also have, you got to just make minutes for between those two, Lonnie Walker, Devin Vassell. Like, that's a lot of guys on the wing already. If anything, I'd probably try to keep Patty over Rudy. I think there is, like, a nice six-man role for Patty, and I know Spurs fans absolutely love him. Like, Jesse.
That's true.
Jesse's going to come into your mentions and slay you for daring to suggest the Spurs don't re-sign Patty Mills.
Well, you know what? Jesse can do that because I think I'm still right on that endeavor. I think that's a fair call. And I love Patty, but at the end of the day, like, the Spurs would wait too long for their young guys to actually turn into, like, prime players, and then they would get them the chance. Maybe the Spurs should just kind of say, you know what? We've waited a long time. We've waited enough. Our young guys are, like, in year five now. Maybe it's time to give them, like, full-time starting minutes. It's been a weird... I think overall, the Spurs are a little bit weird in that way, right? They don't really throw a whole lot of youngsters into the fire right away. And I don't know. When I look at that roster, I kind of go, you need to unleash them now. Like, you need to do something more here than just play in these 20-odd minutes, 20, 25. Like, it's time, man. Go get a couple of guys who plays 35.
Yeah, I forget who tweeted this, and I want to make sure I got this stat right, but it was something like Vassell was the first rookie they haven't sent to the G League in X number of years. But it was like, I think it was like 20 plus years. I don't remember. It was just like this guy, they believe in him enough that they kept him with the full roster all year, which is really impressive.
17 minutes a game. We trust him.
I don't know. Speaking of the young guys, Lonnie Walker now heading into his fourth year, which, like Miles Bridges, means he's up for an extension. Would you extend him if you're the Spurs? And what do you think a fair price is for him?
I probably wouldn't.
Ooh, interesting.
No, so I liked Lonnie, but the offensive efficiency, or lack thereof, isn't great.
Mm-hmm.
I still think he's the type of guy who runs very hot or very cold with nowhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that concerns me a little bit. So I like if he comes up with if he and his agent comes up with an idea that's like suitable to like my expectations somewhere along the lines of like 12.5-13 million. Like, okay, I can sign that and run with that because I know he'll be tradable on that contract.
Yeah.
But if he's coming in asking like 15, 16 million a year, I'm getting really worried very quickly about that type of money.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you there. I think it has to be a team-friendly deal for them to seriously consider it. I don't think he gets in the neighborhood. Derek White got, I think, around 16, 17 million a year.
Same. Sounds about right.
And DeJounte got about 16 million a year.
Yeah.
I don't know that Lonnie Walker can or should expect that much, but yeah, if you take him like to a 3-year 40, 4-year 50, somewhere around there, sure, why not?
Right. I would rather pay Kelton Johnson than I would Lonnie Walker down the line.
That's fair. No. And the other question is, since I mentioned their cap space earlier, Mort, they are going to be, they're at least positioned to be one of the big spenders of free agency. So if they don't re-sign DeRozan, Patty Mills, Rudy Gay, how would you spend that cap space if you're the Spurs?
Well, I mean, it's the Spurs, and we always assume they can fix even the weirdest cases. So is that where Andre Drummond goes? No, I'm kidding. I don't want Andre Drummond near the Spurs. So I have a name for you. And I fully recognize that I don't love that this archetype of power forward.
Laurie?
No, John Collins.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to say, you're advocating for Laurie to be paid? I was going to be surprised. No. Yes, John Collins. Yeah. I
would like that. Yeah, I would like that. I mean, they could max him. I don't think he's worth a max. Let me just say that outright. I don't think he's a max caliber player, but they could, and they wouldn't even lose a whole lot of ground cap space wise. I mean, they could afford to max him and put the Atlanta Hawks in a very, very tough situation.
Oh, no, the Hawks, if he gets a max, they're like, bye.
Yeah, I think so, too. So, I mean, they would then go into next year with, like, Deontay, Vassell, Derek White, Lonnie Walker, Kelton Johnson, Lucas Amanich, John Collins.
Jakob Poeltl.
Oh, yeah, Poeltl, of course, as well. And then they have their pick for this year, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, I believe so, too. Let me just double-check to make absolute sure. Yeah, they do. So then if they get a guy in there, like, you're going to laugh. You know where I'm going with that draft pick.
Yeah,
I don't think he's available there.
Yeah.
I really don't. This guy is good, man. I mean, he just won league MVP at the age of 18 in Turkey. League MVP. I don't think he's going to be around in like 11 and 12, if the Spurs stick there.
Mm-hmm.
But if they move up, then it's someone else. But should Sanguin drop down by like any shot, the Spurs need to be all over it. I don't care. They need to be all over that thing immediately. Maybe Josh Giddey from Australia.
Mm.
That could be interesting. But so, yeah, so they would have a significant youth injection with their draft pick and John Collins, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could really talk about a team that's trying to carve out their own role.
Yeah. And, I mean, worth noting, too, they could always go the cap dump or the salary dump route and use some of that cap space on a contract. You know, if Miami, for instance, is going after Kyle Lowry and needs to clear out space, or Dallas is going after Kawhi Leonard and needs to clear out space, like, take on Josh Richardson if he picks up that player option, as long as it comes with a pick or, you know, something like that. So,
well, have the Spurs ever done that? Like, I'm actually asking, I'm not trying to make a joke about their lack of innovation, but, like, have they ever done something like that? Because this is a team that is notorious for staying competitive, which I really respect, but it does lend the reason to why they won't be as innovative when it comes to rebuilding.
I mean, you can take a cap dump and still have it contribute to winning. Like, Al Horford was productive for the Thunder this year. They just shut him down because he was, in fact, too productive and they needed to tank like crazy. So
that's true. Al Horford could be an interesting subplot there.
Yeah, so, I mean, go after someone like that. Like, I'm not saying they should try to take on a John Wall or anything like that, but, you know, another...
Yeah.
Kevin Love?
I mean, I don't think Jesse's going to be in my mentions.
Well, Cleveland also probably still doesn't want to give up a ton to get off of him. But that's the type of guy who, like, someone who could still be productive, but, you know, not in favor with his current team.
Right. You realize that we've mentioned Jesse so much on this podcast, like, so many people who listen to this show have no idea, like, who he is, and, like, he's just a ghost of this podcast.
I promise he exists. He is our old compatriot from B-Ball Breakdown, who is a great guy, a huge Spurs fan, and to the point where he is at times irrational about how much he loves some of his players.
Yeah, he'll definitely not be in my mentions. That's for damn sure.
Oh, okay. He knows it. We all are. All right, let's wrap up with the Golden State Warriors.
Yes.
Some interesting comments coming out from them, especially after the season. You know, just an absolutely unbelievable year from Stephen Curry. Draymond looks revitalized. I like that he said, like, this year proved they could still F up with other teams' offenses, which is great. You know, Klay Thompson hopefully coming back at full strength next year. Andrew Wiggins performed probably better than a lot of people would have expected coming into the year. So,
that's fair, yeah.
So they have, you know, they have the foundation in place, but they are also looking at just an absolutely mammoth luxury tax bill, and they do have a couple questions. I think the first of which, we have to start with James Wiseman, who really struggled at times this year. The Warriors, it's not fair to say they were substantially better without him, and he's the reason for it, because I think there were multiple reasons for it, but it is worth noting, you know, they were, his plus-minus was just outrageously bad. His on-off was a minus... minus 14.6, which was third worst on the team, second worst among, or actually worst among guys who played at least 100 minutes. So what do they do with Wiseman, given the timeline of Curry, Green, and Thompson? Can you use him as that bridge to the future? Or if that Minnesota pick conveys especially, do you package that and Wiseman for more immediate help?
I mean, you consider everything, I think. That's the number one thing, right? I mean, so I'm not out on Wiseman. I understand he had a bad rookie season. I'm not disputing that whatsoever. He also played just 3 games in college. I mean, he hadn't played competitive basketball for over a year. There was no real training camp whatsoever. no real traction of him getting going. Like, it was just thrown into the deep end, learn to swim. And he sunk. And you know what? That is what it is. He's still 7'1". He's able to hit threes. He's extremely mobile. He's a guy who can even take the ball off the backboard and dribble it the length of the court to do some damage. So I'm not out on him by any stretch. It really depends on what do you think you can get for Wiseman. Because teams are going to lowball you right now because of the rookie season he had. So you have to wonder, are we selling low in that case? Which I would argue, yes, you probably are. And then you look at the pick. If that conveys, let's say it sticks with number 6, as right now is projected to, and you throw in Jordan Poole, this is where it becomes interesting. Mm-hmm. If you offer up all your youth, James Wiseman, the pick, and Jordan Poole, what can you get from that? Can you get... And then maybe Andrew Wiggins for salary cap purposes, just to match it contract. Mm-hmm. Can you get a superstar out of that?
Or, I guess you could like sign and trade Kelly Oubre for salary matching purposes as well. But
as well, yeah. Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, it's a fair... Like, I don't think that package lands Bradley Beal unless it's coming with multiple other future firsts.
Does it land Pascal Siakam? Hmm.
That's interesting. I guess depending on which direction Toronto goes with Lowry in particular, possibly. Ooh, he'd be fun next to Draymond too.
I'm telling you, I brought up this, well, not this exact scenario, but a similar scenario before. I think people are looking like scoring wings and whatnot.
Yeah,
man, if I am the Golden State Warriors, the guy that I want is Pascal Siakam.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think scoring is the issue when you have Stephen Curry and Klay Thompson on your team. So,
well, so Klay is still a question mark, to be fair. Yeah. But I do think that there is a reasonable, more than reasonable chance that he comes back and still is able to shoot. So,
yes, yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, wow.
But like Pascal Siakam, like let's just walk through it here. Defensively, he would be an upgrade. He would be able to be a rebounder, he would be a play initiator, and he would be what, on the depth chart, offensively speaking? Assuming we do your idea, where it is Kelly Oubre that's signed and traded, so they keep Wiggins around. Then Pascal comes into, like, because I don't want to presume that Thompson is going to come back and be the second guy, right off the bat. I don't want to presume that. Right. But that puts Pascal in a situation where he's maybe the number 3 guy, maybe the number two, like
probably the number two. Honestly,
but in the initial, part of the season, and then maybe if Clay proves that no, I'm fine, I'm okay, shut up, then Pascal kind of moves back to that number three guy, and you know what? That's when he gets real dangerous. And then here's the most dangerous part: your fourth option is Andrew Wiggins.
Yeah,
like that could be interesting to me. And then Draymond, who's being asked to probably score a little bit more next year as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am not out by any stretch on the Warriors, and I know people are super down on them right now. I'm just not there. I cannot be down on these Warriors. I think they have so much flexibility.
I mean, yeah, you still have Steph, Clay, and Draymond. You also have Wiseman and potentially two lottery picks this year. You know, like, and one of them could be as high as four. So,
yep.
Right. Yeah. So I'm not out on Golden State either now or moving forward. Like, I think it's going to be tricky. They're going to be in that situation that Boston's been in for a while, where you have to bridge the now and the later, and it's hard to balance both of them. So maybe they do package two of these picks to move up, or package a pick with Wiseman to get some more immediate help. But the other concern for them is the luxury tax. They already have $154.8 million on their books for next year. That is not counting any non-guaranteed salary as well. So, you know, they were asking Bob Myers at the season-ending press conference. This is from our Forbes colleague, Patrick Murray. Asked, like, how much is too much? Like, where is the line that you guys are not willing to go over? And he was saying, like, probably about $400 million in terms of the tax. And
yeah.
You know, but like they very well could be looking at $100+ million tax bill, and it's going to make even spending the taxpayer mid-level, which is all that they're going to have, it's going to get really expensive to spend that thing. So who are some?
Yeah, that's going
to
be a max contract.
Yeah, effectively, if you add the tax cost of it, yes. So who are some? Do you have any, like, cheap veterans in mind who would make sense? Like, really, these are guys who have to come on a minimum deal or, like, close to it.
I might have one, even though he's not a veteran of sorts. He's only played four games in the NBA.
Oh, okay.
For the Houston Rockets this year, Cameron Oliver. I just wrote about him over at Forbes as well with some of the other, like, late-season signings.
Mm-hmm.
He's, I believe, 24, so he's still a bit on the young side. Now, he's not a great defender, I'll say as much, but he can shoot, he can score into the basket, he can rebound, and he can block shots. Like, for a cheap guy, for a guy who's likely going to be had for somewhere around the minimum contract area, that's not bad. He's a guy you can pluck into a lineup, and if you are just riddled with injuries, and he can go get you 17 and 11 and a couple threes. So I think those type of bargain players would be interesting, like where you go after someone who isn't necessarily like super young, like in their low 20s or 19 or whatever. Like, go for someone who's near like the mid-20s area, so you know mm-hmm. there's not a whole lot of potential left, but you also have sort of a mystery box element to you just in terms of how effective how much did the league just fail to look at you. Like, someone like Cameron Oliver, in my opinion, should have been drafted back in 2017, and for whatever reason, he was just never given a shot. Then he played four games for Houston and looked every bit the player that I expected him to be. Why not go that route of seeing you can find some diamonds in the rough for those minimum contracts? I mean, the worst thing that can happen is that they don't pan out and you're out a minimum contract. Big whoop.
Right. I mean, guys like Jeff Green, Carmelo, Nick Batum, Dwight Howard, Bryn Forbes, all on minimum deals this year, all making an impact on their respective teams. Bazemore came back to the Warriors, was on a goal. I'm not saying all of those guys for Golden State. I'm just saying, like, those types of bargains do exist. Even though it's rare, and I mean, you're looking at...
They're like, old, though.
Right. You're looking at ring chaser types, for sure.
Yeah, and I wonder... And that's the thing, right? You just don't know if you're signing an old ring chaser. You just don't know when the drop-off is.
Right.
Like, sometimes you sign a guy and you go, oh, this is the guy. This guy is going to really put our bench over the top, and we're going to be championship level material. And that guy just says, poof, I'm dust now.
Right, exactly. Yeah, therein lies the problem. So the Warriors, last question about them. If they do keep their picks, let's say they land at 6 and 14. I know you're going to say Sengun for 6, but they were talking about bringing in like more veteran help. And they were saying, you know, at number two last year, that's where you're like looking BPA. We're swinging for the fences. We're considering upside here. At 14, we might have a little more flexibility to just prioritize a guy who we can come in right away, plug and play. So we're not going for youth and upside. We're going for dependable. Does anyone jump out at you who could be a good target for them?
Two, actually. Corey Kispert out of Gonzaga and Davion Mitchell from Baylor.
Okay. Yeah, I was hoping you'd say Mitchell at least. So yeah.
Yeah. Is it Davion or Davion? It's the pronunciation game. It's
no idea. Talk to me in 2 months and I'll have read up about these prospects.
Yeah. No, but those two guys, I think, because they're a bit on the older side, but they're productive. Like, Kispert is more of a shooter and scorer than he is a defender. Mitchell is more of a defender, one of those in-your-face type of guys. Mm-hmm. But they're polished in their respective roles, so I wouldn't hate that. I think they come in with a certain baseline. But like, also, at the same time, I understand that this is a different scenario because it would be your second pick and whatnot. Like, taking Kispert at 14, that's high as well. I don't know if I would. I mean, I know he's projected to go higher in a lot of mocks, but I don't agree with that. So I think you would be stretching a little bit if you go with an older, like senior or junior or whatever. But if they identify those players and they go, you know what, sure, like that's enough grade. That is someone who can come in right off the cusp and play. Sure, why not? It'd be a reach, but I get the logic.
Yeah, well, they're going to be one of the most interesting teams to watch this offseason. That's for damn sure. So
let me ask you one final question though. Can you imagine Twitter? Can you imagine Twitter if they jump up to one with their own pick?
Oh god!
And the Minnesota pick lands at 4.
Oh god!
Can you imagine Twitter? And also, can you imagine Bob Myers? He would at first be celebrating, then he would remember how much money those draft picks attached to.
Just he would be packing Andrew Wiggins bags at that point.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah,
but my God, that if they jumped up and got Cade Cunningham, you know, I think we would see the longest stretch of people calling the NBA draft rigged.
Yes,
ever.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I mean, they have some major potential to reshape their roster. We'll start with the lottery, and I think that's going to inform a lot of what they do this offseason.
Yeah, totally agree.
Well, that is a good place for us to wrap up. So thank you all, as always, for listening in today. Hope you're still enjoying the playoffs. We will get back to playoff coverage next episode. We just had to kick these teams to the curb before it got too far in, because we're going to have to say goodbye to a few more teams pretty soon.
Yeah.
As always, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we recorded our show today on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own room and engage with other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be a part of our podcast. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Eventually, you'll start plugging the YouTube channel as well.
Until then, you please do that.
Well, then I'll give it a plug.
Yeah.
Because we're doing daily uploads. You have become more and more featured in those uploads because we're spreading it around a little bit. I'm doing some kind of essay videos from my perspective where I'm standing in front of a camera. And then we also do these podcast episodes, sometimes special episodes where you and I like set aside 20 minutes. We record a video to talk about whatever topic we find interesting. Now I already got you on the hook to talk about Ben Simmons at one point. So I'll look forward to doing that. So check out the NBA show. I know we're super creative with the names, but on YouTube, we would very much look forward to getting above the 1,000 subscribers pretty soon. We're at well over 800, so won't be far. So yeah, go in, like, subscribe, and share.
Very good. All right, catch you later, Bart.
Later, Brian.